falling like rain. Holy Spirit, come, come fill this place as we praise your name.
Mephibosheth was declared king by Abner, and he decided that he wanted to keep this family of Saul going. And as we saw last week at the beginning of 2 Samuel, a war breaks out. There's strife, there's tension between the tribe of Judah, who knows that they have the most awesome king of the world, King David. And the rest of Israel is falling after Ishbosheth, who is kind of like the more natural guy, because he's the son of the last king. Chapter 3, verse 1. Now, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. Sons were born to David in Hebron. Hebron is one of the cities in Judah. It is where David is ruling. It's where he is setting up his government, is in Hebron. Hebron, Hebron, Hebron. You'll hear it pronounced a lot of different ways. And so now we're going to look a little bit at David's family. His sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. His second, Kileab, by Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream by David's wife Eglah. These were born to David in Hebron. Now, some of these sons, this first son is Amnon. His name means faithful. He's the first son. He's what we would call the crown prince. He's this guy that's the slam dunk to become the next king, because that's usually what happens. Usually the oldest son will become king. Amnon's going to cause David a bit of heartburn, heartache, a bit of trouble in the family, because Amnon will one day rape his half-sister Tamar. He will rape her. Strange, strange thing that's going to happen in David's family. Kileab, his name means like his father. Now, maybe you got that name afterwards, where his mom said, "You're just like your father," or something like that. I don't know. That's the way I read it. Kileab, you're just like your father. I think I've heard that in my household from time to time. His mom was Abigail, and you remember, she's the gal. Strange story how she marries David. Remember, David sends messengers to her husband, saying, "Look, we've been taking care of your sheep out in the wilderness, and we hear you're having a party. Would you mind sharing a little bit with us? Because we've been kind of taking care of you free of charge." And Nabal, who was her husband, you know, he's a big jerk. In fact, his name means fool. And he kind of blows David off and calls David a bunch of names and whispers and mutters and sends the messengers away with nothing. David gets really ticked off. David wants to send his guys out and just eliminate all of Nabal and his family. Abigail hears about this, and she realizes, "Oh my gosh, what is my idiot husband doing?" How many of you ladies ever thought that thought? What is my idiot husband doing? Well, she gathers up a whole bunch of stuff, boatloads of crackers and Cheez-Its and stuff like that, and she delivers this present to David. And she talks him out of wiping everybody out. And in the end, David thanks her, because he realizes, "I could have just done the biggest idiot, stupid, bozo head thing I've ever done by wiping out a guy just because he didn't give us some cookies, you know." When Nabal hears what Abigail had done, and that he almost got wiped out, he's been in the middle of a big party, he's drunk, and he hears about this, and he has a stroke. And for a couple of days, he's lying there on the ground, frozen. And then he dies. David hears about this and says, "You know, that Abigail, she stuck her neck out for me." And he goes and he marries the girl. They have a kid named Kileab. The writer of Chronicles calls him by a different name. The book of Chronicles calls Kileab Daniel. So I don't know if his name was Kileab Daniel Davidson, because these are all probably Davidsons, because they're all David's sons. They're Davidsons. Come on, I'm trying up here. It's trying. Okay. And we know nothing about this son. Some people suggest that he dies at an early age, and that's why we don't know anything about him. Who knows? Absalom, his name is father. His name means my father is peace. Ab in Hebrew means father. Shalom is peace. Shalom. Solomon is a form of that name. My father is peace. Absalom, he's the full brother to Tamar. And so when his older brother Amnon rapes his sister, his full sister, he is one ticked off man. And dad does nothing about it. Dad doesn't do it. Dad hears about the rape and doesn't do anything about it. Absalom decides to take things into his own hands. He gathers his friends and they make plans and they invite all of the rest of David's sons to a big party. And they make sure that Amnon shows up. And then the word is given. And Amnon is put to death. Absalom kills his half-brother. He runs off to Geshur, and he hides out there for a while. He'll be brought back from Geshur, and he will eventually turn his back on David. He will sweet-talk the nation into following him. He stands at the gates. He stands at the front door of the church and shakes everybody's hand and say, "That David, you know, he's not really with it. He doesn't care anything about you, but oh, I care lots about you." Kisses people's hand, kisses their babies, and then one day rises up and is about to kill his dad, and his dad escapes. That's Absalom. My father is peace. He, we're told, is the daughter of the king of Geshur. Didn't used to know where Geshur was. We weren't for sure where Geshur was. But now we are sure where Geshur is. I used to kind of think it was the area northwest of the Sea of Galilee. But now we actually know the city because they've found it through the excavations. And it also happens to have a dual name. It is also the name of Bethsaida, the hometown of Petros, Peter. And they found this by the excavations, and they found this place. Geshur was a pagan city. Talmai, the king of Geshur, he was a pagan king. And David marries into his family. When Absalom runs away because he's killed his brother, he runs to Geshur. Why? Because that's where grandpa lives. That's where mom is from. That's where it's safe. That's why he runs up there. The fourth was Adonijah, the son of Haggith. When David's getting up in years, his name means my Lord, Adon, our Adoni. My Lord is Yahweh. That's the Yah at the end. When David's getting up in years, he's kind of tottering, look like he's going to die any day. Adonijah figures, I'm the next in line, because by Adonijah's time, by the end of David's life, the other guys are all gone. They've been killed. They've killed each other. They've done all this stuff. And Adonijah thinks, well, it's my turn. And so he just gathers everybody up and says, I'm going to declare myself king. Why not? Dad hasn't done anything yet, so I'm just going to step in. And he declares himself king. And then he finds out, whoops, David planned to have Solomon be king, and he gets in trouble and things get messy. The fifth, Shephatiah, his name means Yahweh has judged. We don't know anything about Shephatiah. Know nothing about Shephatiah. There is a lesson here. I don't know if you've picked up on this. David has a messy family. Messy, messy, messy family. It's the thing of soap operas, right? We've got rapes. We've got intrigue. We've got, spy versus spy. We've got assassinations. We've got coups. We've got all kinds of stuff. Sons trying to kill their father. Oh, my gosh. Talk about a messy family. I'll give you bonus points if you know the words, if you sing along.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They're all together ooky, the Addams Family. The house is a museum, when people come to see them, they really are a scream, the Addams Family.
What was the name of the hand in the box?
Thing.
There you go. All right. This is a baby boomer quiz, isn't it? Have you ever looked back at that show and think, that kind of reminds me of my family? I don't know that I want to ask for hands. I really ought to. Oh, what the heck? Let's be brave. How many of you think you come from a messy family or are living in a messy family? Look around you. You are not alone. That's my whole point here. King David, the man after God's own heart. I think you could probably make a case he was a lousy dad. Probably. I don't know. But I'll tell you what, I'm not going to throw accusations at King David. I don't want him coming up to me in heaven and saying, what were you talking about? What do you think? Who do you think you are talking to me about it? Saying I'm a lousy dad. Because sometimes even the best dads have rebellious kids. And if you're wondering about that, all you have to do is look at Genesis chapter 3. God the Father has two kids, Adam and Eve, and they rebel against God. You can't make a better case for a better dad than God, or I don't think you could. Gang, family, messy families are not uncommon. It's the norm. You're not unique. You're not alone. And if you're a parent and you worry about your kids, you know, you are part of the human race. You are part of the human race. Don't miss this fact, gang, and beat yourself up too much. I mean, yes, we can all learn to be better parents. Yes, we can all grow to be a better part of the family. Absolutely. But gang, messy families started in Genesis chapter 3. Now, the sixth son, his name was Ithream. His name means prophet of the people. Not like prophet like he tells the future kind of prophet, but prophet like in making dollars. I don't know what that means, what that's about. All these sons are born to David during the 7.5 years that he rules in Hebron. Now, it mentions that, you know, Absalom's mom was the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. There's something I kind of want to explore a little bit with you here. We can kind of think about these multiple marriages. By the way, this is married to the same, all these women at the same time. This is not marriage, divorce, marriage, divorce, marriage, divorce. This is as messy as you can guess that this is. We can think about these multiple marriages being all about sex. I'll bet if I was to dig into every man's mind in here, we're probably going, you know, yeah, that's probably what it's all about. You know, that's probably what's behind it. Could be. But not completely. One of the things that David is doing here is a practice very common to powerful men, to kings. It was very common for kings to make treaties with their neighboring kingdoms by marrying the king's daughter. Because if the little king's daughter is living in your castle, then the king next door might be a little bit reluctant to attack you with his army. A stray arrow may catch his little girl or something like this. That's kind of the rough idea of some of these things. We're going to look at Solomon eventually. And we're going to talk about his, you know, 1,000 women. And people have, you know, some guys go off in wild fantasies. It's about politics. It's about creating a stable kingdom. That was their idea behind this. Doesn't make it right. Doesn't make it right. I'm just telling you what's part of what the process is. God had some pretty clear laws for the kings long before the kings came. They wrote this down 400 years before the kings. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, it says about kings, it says, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, for the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Now, in Deuteronomy, God gives various reasons why you shouldn't do this, these other things, like the wives, that your heart would be turned away. But that's not the only reason underlying these things. These all have to do with trust God. Are you trusting God in these things? Or are you trusting your horses? Are you going to trust God for the security of your kingdom? Or are you going to trust the fact that you've married the daughter of every king you could find? Are you trusting in God for helping your kingdom? Or are you trusting in the fact that you're amassing as much gold and silver as you can? God wants his leaders to trust him, not in military might, which is horses, not in their marriage alliances or their wives, and not in their gold. Billy Graham said years ago that the three main temptations that men tend to fight are sex, money, and power. And the way it normally plays out in a guy's life when you're younger, it tends to be the sex is the struggle that we struggle against. It tends to be that as you grow a little bit older, you're looking for more money. You want the promotions. You want to get the car. You want to get the house. And when you kind of get up in years, you kind of have some of the stuff. And what's left? You want to be in control. That's why you run for president. That's why you run for governor or city council or whatever, because it's good to be, you know, powerful over people. You see these same three things aimed at the kings. You know, don't multiply wives. That's the sex. Don't hoard gold and silver. That's the money. And don't multiply horses. That horses in those days is military might. It's power. God's desire is that we learn to trust him and not these other things. It's not wrong to have a job. It's not wrong to be paid well. It's not wrong to be married. Not at all. But what are you counting on? What are you trusting? Psalm 27. And David wrote this. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of Yahweh, our God. We want our trust to be in the right thing. Where is our trust? One other issue is the one wife thing. Because David didn't do that, did he? And by the way, he's not done with wives. After being married for 50 years, this guy takes a careful look at his wife one day and he says, 50 years ago, we had a cheap house, a junk car, slept on a sofa bed and watched a 10-inch black and white TV, but I got to sleep every night with a hot 19-year-old girl. Now, I got a million-dollar home, a $40,000 car, a nice big bed, and a large screen TV, but I'm sleeping with a 70-year-old woman. It seems to me that you're not holding up your side of things. It was guys that chuckled at that. That's interesting. His wife is a very reasonable woman. She told him that it was okay with her if he goes out and finds a hot 19-year-old girl, and she'll make sure that he would once again be living in a cheap house, driving a junk car, sleeping on a sofa bed, and watching a 10-inch black and white TV. Aren't older women great? Yes, they are. They know how to solve an old guy's problems. Don't go down the road of justifying stuff based on their lives. David's multiple marriages were never meant to be a standard for anybody to follow. He broke the rules in doing this. God's rule, and see, that's what always ticked me off with the Joseph Smith thing, you know, and having multiple wives and the stuff that the Mormons did for a while. You know, and they talk about, you know, it's what the patriarchs did. Well, it's how the patriarchs blew it. It's not what they did right. God's rule for marriage has always been one woman, one man. How do we get that? From Genesis. God created Adam and he created Eve. And I'm not just the one that points to that. When Jesus pointed to the ideal marriage, he pointed to Adam and Eve. Learn satisfaction in your mate. Let your fountain be blessed. This is Proverbs 5:18. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. Learn to enjoy your spouse. Cultivate that. That's something you can grow. That's something that doesn't just happen. That's not just, you know, the feeling's gone and I just can't get it. No, you get it back for Pete's sake. Don't settle for fizzling romance. Cook it up. Heat it up. That's God's desire for marriage. One woman, one man. Chapter 3, verse 6. Let's do a few more verses. So, and now it was so, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. Now, again, Ishbosheth is the remaining son that wasn't killed at Mount Gilboa, and Abner is making sure that he is propping up Ishbosheth, and Abner's probably got a few years on Ishbosheth. He knows what he's doing, and he's making sure that things are in control. And Saul, verse 7, had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiya. So Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Now, Rizpah, her name means pavement. It's probably because men walked all over her, is my guess. That was a little bit of a joke. You could snicker at that one. That was okay. Rizpah is what we call a concubine. What is a concubine? I'm not quite sure. It's not a porcupine. It is something less than a wife. There is some kind of a connection there. They will have children, but it's not the full-on marriage. Now, does she get, you know, $20 less a week for her grocery money? I don't know. I don't know what the deal is. I don't know how men cook up these things. Actually, I do know how men cook up these things, but we don't want to talk about that. She's not a full wife, but she slept with Saul, the guy that's dead. She had kids by Saul. She's got this connection to power. We don't hear anything about Saul's wives, his other wife or whatever. Rizpah is there. And whether she's a wife or she's a concubine, well, maybe she's not a wife, but she's the next best thing. Because she's a link, she's a tie to Saul. We're going to see in David's later years that they're going to put David together with a young gal named Abishag. Now, there was nothing sexual between David and Abishag, but David was getting really old, and he was having a hard time staying warm at night, and they couldn't turn up the thermostat in the room, and so they figured, well, what are we going to do? And as you know, two are better than one, and when you are sleeping with your honey, you get warm. And sometimes, you know, that's a good thing. And so they got this gal, they hired her, and that was her job, just to keep David warm. She wasn't even a concubine, but she was a connection to David. And one of David's sons, Adonijah, even after he doesn't get to become king, he wants to see if he can marry Abishag. Why? Because he wants the connection with the king. It's a political thing. It's a power thing. Solomon realizes that. And Solomon has Adonijah dispatched. Look that one up. He's dead. So, Ishbosheth is a little paranoid. Rizpah is not his mom. It's his, I don't know, what do you call a, what, your stepmom or something like this? But he thinks that he caught Abner making goo-goo eyes with Rizpah across the banquet hall one day. He's just sure that he saw this. And he's sure that it's more than that. He's sure that Abner must be sneaking out and visiting Rizpah. And what does that mean? He's thinking that Abner's fixing to take over. Because that's part of what you do, is you take the previous king's wives. So, he accuses Abner of sleeping with Rizpah. Verse 8. Abner became very angry at the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show loyalty to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hand of David. And you charge me today with a fault concerning this woman? You got to be kidding me." Kid, he's doing everything he can to make sure that you stay in power. A dog's head that belongs to Judah. Now, that's quite a wonderful statement there. A dog's head. Dogs weren't considered highly loved creatures, not like your little pet dogs. Dogs were thought to be horrible creatures. And he's just a dog's head that belongs to Judah, which is the other guys, the enemy. What, do you think I'm a traitor working for David or something? What are you thinking? The truth is that Abner's been loyal to Ishbosheth. He says, verse 9, "May God do so to Abner and more also if I do not do for David as the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba." And he could not, and he, Ishbosheth, could not answer Abner, not another word, because he feared him. He's scared of the old man. The old man's powerful. I mean, shoot, the old man's the reason I'm here in the first place. And he's scared for the fact of the reality that he's just greatly offended Abner, and that Abner's threatening to turn the kingdom over to David. "So you're afraid I'm going to do this? Well, I'm just going to go ahead and do it." There is something that some of us could pay attention to. And that's the trouble that our suspicions get us into. Sometimes our suspicions are correct. You know, they say just because you think everybody's out to get you doesn't mean it's not true, right? And some of us hold to that. You know, I know they're out to get me, and it's got to be true sometime, you know. And sometimes the people that you are suspicious of, sometimes the people you are thinking that are thinking mean things towards you or planning mean things towards you, sometimes that's actually true. But gang, sometimes our very sometimes our very suspicions are the cause of the trouble. And I'm looking at you, and I am just convinced that you are thinking something about me. And I look at you, and I give you the evil eye. And I give you the stink eye, you know, because I know what you're thinking or doing. And then you look at me and you go, "Oh my gosh, this person hates me." And things build up from there. I watch it happen in church all the time. All the time. And every once in a while, we'll try to have people talk to each other, and they'll say just this same kind of thing. "Well, I saw them look across the room at me, and they gave me this look." Be careful. Some of your suspicions are wrong. Some of your suspicions are wrong. And sometimes your suspicions only cause the problem to become real. Ishbosheth is afraid that Abner's trying to take over and he's going to lose control. Well, by golly, his very suspicions are going to make that exact thing happen. Not because Abner was planning on it, but because the offense of Ishbosheth being suspicious. Finally, Abner, he throws up his hands and says, "I've had it with this kid. What what a jerk. Oh my gosh. You see how it happens? And see, sometimes what we think we're thinking, that they're thinking, is not what they're thinking. They've actually, you know, actually went to Del Taco and had too many burritos. And they're sitting there thinking, what am I going to do with this gas that's building up? And they have this look across their face and they're going, oh, I knew I should have come for Shannon's dinner. I would have been much better off. And they're thinking these thoughts and their face is going into, you know, contortions. And they happen to look across the room and their gaze happens to cross you. And you look at them and you think, oh my gosh, he doesn't like me. Oh my gosh, he heard what I said about him the other day. Or whatever. Gang, we need to work in reality. We need to live in reality. And sometimes our suspicions are causing the trouble. Not that there's anything real in it at all. Verse 12, Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David. So Abner says that he just had it. He sends messengers to David saying, whose is the land? Saying also, make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel to you. So he's done with Ish-bosheth. And he sends a delegation to David with messages saying, you know what? I've had it with this kid. We've all known that you're supposed to be king in the first place. We've heard the prophecies. Let's just do this thing. You bring me on board. I'll bring the rest of Israel with me, and we'll make you the king you're supposed to be. And David said, good. I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, that you shall not see my face until you bring first Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. So David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, whom I betrothed to myself, for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Now, in case you missed the story a while back, Michal, this was David's very first wife. She was part of the reward for David killing Goliath. Part of the reward that Saul offered was, you know, your family will go tax-free for the rest of their lives, and they get the princess, you know. And so it eventually lands with Michal. First they tried the older sister, and then that didn't quite work out because David's a little freaked out marrying into the king's family. In fact, David thinks, what am I doing marrying the king's daughter? I'm just like a shepherd, for Pete's sake. What's this all about? Saul, of course, wants to use this for his advantage, because by this time Saul's starting to get freakishly jealous of David. And so remember, he cooks up this plot and says, well, I'll tell him that, you know, all you have to do is buy her as my daughter, buy her as a wife with a dowry of 100 Philistine foreskins. Now, in case you're wondering, the Philistines aren't going to give up their foreskins willingly. David's not going to go down to the town square in Gath and set up a booth and say, $5, I'll pay you $5 if you give me your foreskin. That's just not going to happen. He's going to have to kill them. And of course, you know, David, being David, he just goes overboard. And he kills 200 Philistines. And he ends up marrying Michal. When the craziness with Saul gets worse and worse, Michal rescues David because she finds out that Pop is sending assassins over to kill her husband. She kind of likes David. She loves David. And remember, David escapes, and that's probably the last he's seen of her, because he's been on the run. He had been on the run ever since, running for his life. In the meantime, she was given to another man. So David wants his first wife back. You want me to become king? On one condition. I want my first wife back. Now, why does he want that? Is it because he loves her? It could be. It could be. That's why I put this up number one. It could be out of love. It could also, gang, as we've talked about, because of power. She's the daughter of the king. She's the one who brings national unity by joining the tribe of Judah, which already follows David. He doesn't have a problem with Judah following him. It's the rest of the nation. And if the king's daughter is back married to him, then that heals the wound. You see how that works? Okay, verse 15. So Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel the son of Laish. I just find it fascinating that Ish-bosheth goes along with this whole thing, because he is scared to death of Abner. And so he goes along with this whole thing. And then her husband went along with her to Bahurim, weeping behind her. We're going to see Bahurim at the end of David's life. He'll make a stop there as he's fleeing from Absalom. But this husband is weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, go return, go home. And he returned. Now Bahurim, David has set up his government down in the south in Hebron. And Michal could be either in Gibeah where her family is from, or she could be living with her brother over in Mahanaim. Bahurim is back over by Gibeah, and it's on the way to Hebron. So wherever she is at, they're stopping at Bahurim, which is just outside of the outskirts of Jerusalem. And that's as far as the husband is allowed to go. Verse 17. Now Abner had communicated with the elders of Israel, saying, in time past you were seeking for David to be king over you. So this is to the elders of Israel. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and the hand of all their enemies. They've known these prophecies. The whole nation has known. And Abner spoke in the hearing of Benjamin, which is the tribe of who? It's Saul. This is King Saul. That's his homeboys, is from the tribe of Benjamin. And so Abner also speaks in the hearing of Benjamin. Then Abner also went to speak in the hearing of David in Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel and the whole house of Benjamin. So Abner and his 20 men with him came to David. He's got an entourage there. His 20 men came to David at Hebron. And David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. Then Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away and he went in peace. They've done it. They've kind of sealed the deal. They've signed the treaties. Now, again, it just blows me away how they all knew that David would be king one day, because that's what the prophecies were. Word had leaked out that when David was still a boy, Samuel the prophet had poured oil over this kid's head and declared that this was the next king long before Saul was done. And now the whole nation, they're waking up to the fact that they need to be doing what God has already chosen. Now, I'm going to bring this up over and over again because I think it's so important. This is one of the lessons that is it's a good lesson. There, a guy wrote a book years ago called The Tale of Three Kings, and it covers this kind of thing. And the issue is, how do you get your place? How do you become king? How do you find your calling? And you're going to see through these passages, through these stories, there's various ways you get there. You can choose various paths. Saul kind of had his own boatload of problems. And one of the things we remember him for was his insane jealousy, his insecurity, and the stupid, horrible, crazy things he did out of insecurity. That's kind of probably the takeaway we want with Saul. We don't go there. You know, we need to be secure in who we are in the Lord. And if God raises up another, well, isn't that kind of okay? Isn't it okay for God to do what he wants to do? I'm still me, and God still loves me. God still has a purpose for my life. David, in this vein, in how do you find your place, how do you become king over what you're supposed to be king over, the hallmark of David is patience. Over and over, he has a chance to take things into his own hands. We saw over and over how he had opportunities to kill King Saul. A couple of times, he had him right there. You know, they're alone, and Saul's asleep, and David's got a sword or a spear or a javelin, or he's got guys with him who are just ready to just lop his head off, and it's over. And his own guys are egging him on, saying, this is it, this is the time. And David kept saying, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm not taking this on my own. I'm going to wait for God to do this. And he does this over and over and over again. We're going to see with Absalom. Absalom takes things into his own hands. Absalom figures that his dad's a jerk. Absalom figures that he's the one who should rightfully become king. Dad's time is over. Absalom is the one who stations himself at the city gates and sweet talks everybody and bad mouths the boss. You know, never to his face, but to everybody else, he bad mouths the boss. Tells everybody about, David's okay, but I could do a little bit better, you know. Puffs himself up, bad mouths the other guy. Kind of wins people over, kisses them, makes them feel happy to be about him and stuff. And then the day comes, he shows his hand, and he's out to kill his dad. Well, that's a lousy way to become king. You're going to see as we go through Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, there are plenty of kings who will do this. But David is the man after God's own heart. He's the one we want to follow. And of course, we've already talked a little bit about Adonijah, about assuming this. He was presumptuous. Of course I'm going to be the next king. And then he took things into his own hand. He wasn't going to kill David because David had a couple days left anyway. Dad's been wheezing a lot, and Abishag tells me that Pop's about to kick the bucket, so let's just get this thing off the ground and, let's get off to a running start, He's practical, and he's wrong. He's assuming something that wasn't right. When you feel that God has a tug on your life, gang, it's really important that you be careful how you go about doing it. You want to do it in the name of God. Remember all the stuff that Gail taught us about the name of God, who God is, compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, and all of this kind of stuff. That's the spirit we want to do things in. Okay, chapter 3, verse 22. At that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid that brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. Now, so all this negotiation has taken place. They've signed the peace treaties, and they've clicked their champagne glasses, and they've traded signature pens, and they've done all this, had the photo shoot and everything. And Joab missed the whole thing because he'd been off raiding, that's kind of what he does, And when Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away, and he's already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing. Abner just came to pull one over on you, buddy. Joab is suspicious of Abner, and he's either suspicious or he's lying. He's either really suspicious of Abner because, Abner has been facing him in battle. They're the ones that have been the head generals facing each other. Or he's lying to tell a story to David to make David turn on Abner and kill him. Because remember, Abner is the one who killed Joab's youngest brother, Asahel, back at the pool of Gibeon just a few chapters ago, when they were having those contests that turned into a battle and turned into a war. Abner, he tried not to. He warned Asahel, don't you come any near, kid, because you come any near, you think you're going to kill me and take my weapons and stuff. I'm sorry, but I will have to kill you. And Asahel kept pursuing. And Abner killed him. And he knew Joab. He knew that this was his brother. Joab has reasons to be suspicious. There's one other thing I was thinking about. Because if Abner joins David, who do you think is going to be the head of the army of Israel? Probably in that contract, Abner kept his role as the head of the armies of Israel. He already controls 11 of the tribes. And right now, Joab's in the, you know, sweet spot, because he's David's army head, you know. So when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah. But David did not know it. And when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach so that he died, for the blood of Asahel, his brother. So he took him aside to the gate. When you go to Israel, the gates of the cities, you're not just talking like a little garden gate here. The way they built these gates is they built them with gaps in them. So there would be an outer wall, and then they would build houses or buildings away from it. And there would be like a little side cubicle, so that if you open the gates and these are bad guys, you can attack them and stuff like that. So he takes them aside in the gate. That's where they are. And he kills the guy. And it says he died for the blood of Asahel. Joab's reason for killing Abner had nothing to do with thinking that Abner was going to betray David. It was for one reason and one reason only. It was revenge on his brother. That's what the writer tells us. One of the problems of ancient Israel was this concept of the ancient blood feuds. This is what they, as they came out of Egypt, they carried this stuff with them. It was like the Hatfields and the McCoys. If you had something to do, if you were involved in some way with the death of a family member of mine, I was obligated for the honor of my family to hunt you down and kill you. But of course, once I kill you, then your brother or sister was obligated to come down and hunt me down. And it goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. This is one of the reasons why God set up these things called the cities of refuge, where there were six cities spaced out through Israel. There was three on the eastern side of the Jordan, and three on the western side, all within a day's run. And the idea is that if you accidentally killed somebody, then you headed for the hills and headed for one of these cities, and you would say, "I just accidentally killed somebody. Help me, protect me from the Avenger of Blood." That's what they called. I don't know if you had to buy a cape to do that, to be called the Avenger of Blood, or have secret weapons or something. Anyway. The Avenger of the Blood was the guy in the family who was bound to get back at you. Well, the people in the city, and these were all Levitical cities, the priests were in charge of all these cities. They would hold court. They would have a court case to determine, was this accident or was this murder? If it's murder, then you would be put to death. If it was found to be manslaughter, to be an accident, well, then they would protect you, and you had to stay in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest, which is a whole other thing. That's why they set this up, was because of these blood feuds, just like Joab taking revenge on Abner. What's really strange, Joshua chapter 20, when it lists the cities of refuge on the western side of the Jordan, it says this: so they appointed Kadesh in Galilee, in the mountains of Naphtali, Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim, they're going north to south, and Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron, in the mountains of Judah. You know what's really fascinating? This takes place in a city of refuge. Theoretically, Abner should have been at least have had a court case. So what you see here with the revenge of Joab, he not only is crossing the line with revenge, but he's flatly doing it in the face of God, because he's doing it in a city of refuge of all places. Of any place Abner should have been safe was Hebron. Instead, he dies there. The Bible says, "Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place for wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord." Be careful about taking revenge. Verse 28. Afterward, when David heard it, he said, my kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab. Let this guilt rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house. And let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has a discharge or is a leper, who leans on a staff or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So that's, by the way, not a nice thing to say about your nephew. That's not a blessing. Oh, God bless my nephew. No, this is a curse. So Joab and Abishai killed his brother, killed Abner, because he had killed their brother Asahel and Gibeon in battle. So Joab's not alone in this. Abishai is a part of this, apparently. He's a part of this whole event. Abishai, the three sons. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who are with him, tear your clothes, gird yourselves with sackcloth, and mourn for Abner. And King David followed the coffin. So they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king sang a lament over Abner and said, should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. As a man falls before wicked men, so you fell. Then all the people wept over him again. By the way, David is calling Joab a wicked person. And when all the people came to persuade David to eat food while it was still day, David took an oath saying, God do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner, the son of Ner. So David's sincere grief, the things that he's saying, the things that he's doing, convinces the people that David had nothing to do with this. Then the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. Now, this is just the thing that always baffles me. I don't have the answer to this. So if you come up and say, I don't get this, neither do I. Sons of Zeruiah. Zeruiah is David's older sister. Got a couple of sisters. So these are his nephews. They could be about David's age since she's older. David lays this curse on Joab, but he doesn't put Joab to death. At the end of his life, look what David says about Joab. This is what David says to his son Solomon. This is a charge that he gives Solomon as he's about to die. Moreover, you know also what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa. That's another story that's coming up, whom he killed. And he shed the blood of war in peacetime and put the blood of war on his belt that was around his waist and on his sandals that were on his feet. Therefore, do according to your wisdom and do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace. He's basically telling his son, when I die, go kill Joab. Go take care of him. Now, why David doesn't do this, I have no idea. It could be that maybe he's afraid of Joab because Joab is quite a character. It could be because it's his oldest sister's kid. Maybe he's really afraid of his sister, you know, and I don't know. Who knows? It could be that there are some people that are thinking that this was a justifiable killing because he's killing for his brother's sake. Who knows? Strangest thing. This is one of the things I don't get, because David is free. He's quick to put some people to death, but he doesn't put Joab to death. Chapter 4, verse 1. And also often he will say, oh, these sons of Zeruiah, what a bunch of trouble they are. So it's not like this is the only time he's ticked off. He's often ticked off at his nephews. When Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart, and all Israel was troubled. I mean, he realizes, oh my gosh, even Abner is now dead. I am big trouble. Now, Saul's son had two men who were captains of troops. The name of one was Baana, the name of the other Rechab, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite of the children of Benjamin, for Beeroth also was a part of Benjamin, because the Beerothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourners there until this day. Where are Beeroth and Gittaim? I do not know. I've seen maps with them on multiple places. We don't know. But their tribe, their cities within the tribe of Benjamin, which is right around Jerusalem. Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old. when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled, and it happened when, as she made haste to flee, that he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. This verse is kind of stuck in here for, I don't know why, just to let us know about something, a guy that we're going to find out about later, Mephibosheth. We're told why he's crippled, because he was a young kid when his pop died and his nurse freaked out and dropped him, and it was a mess. Verse 5. Then the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, these are the two captains of Ishbosheth, set out and came at about the heat of the day to the house of Ishbosheth, who was lying on his bed at noon. And they came there all the way into the house as though to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. Now, apparently the food stores for the army were kept at the king's house. So they say, well, we're just going to get some food for our troops. And they sneak, they go in past the doorkeeper. Josephus records that it was a woman who kept the door and that she had fallen asleep. And they go in and they kill Ishbosheth. And when they came into the house, he was lying on his bed in his bedroom. They struck him and killed him, beheaded him, and took his head, and were all night escaping through the plain. Now, so they're starting off at Mahanaim. The plain is talking about the plain of the River Jordan, and it takes them all night to cross the Jordan, and they go all the way up to Hebron, to where David is. Verse 8, and it says, they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. It's quite a trophy. It's to prove that he's dead. And to the king, and said to the king, here's the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. And the Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day of Saul and his descendants. Now, these guys seem to think they're doing David a favor by killing Ishbosheth. I mean, why not? I mean, they're kind of like at odds with each other, you know, and why wait till the presidential election? Let's just kill the opponent, you know, and take his head over to the other guy, and he'll give me a prize or something. But that's not the way David operates, is it? That's not the way he wants to become king. David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, and said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity. When someone told me, saying, look, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag, the one who thought I would give him a reward for his news. And now we saw that last week at the beginning of chapter 1. This guy who claimed to have killed Saul. And David is so upset that Saul is dead, which totally baffles me. It's his enemy, for Pete's sake. It's the guy who's been trying to kill him for several years. But he is David's king. And he's dead. And this guy claims to have killed him. David put him to death. So verse 11, how much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? I mean, my gosh, you aren't even in battle. You're just a bunch of assassins. Therefore, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth? So David commanded his young men, and they executed them, cut off their hands and feet, and hanged them by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. So they execute these guys. Why do they cut off their hands and feet? I think it's the idea of indicating that those are the parts of their bodies that helped perpetrate the crime. Their hands killed the guy, and their feet took him across the border. At this point, David still has, or at this moment, David has his head on right. This is what's right. And he doesn't give them a reward for doing evil. He gives them the punishment that they deserve. He's got a good sense right now of right and wrong. And that's it for tonight. I have a sense of right and wrong, and it's right that I stop at 8:30. Because it would be wrong for me to go too late. So let's stand and pray. Father, Lord, I am grateful to be reminded that even our greatest heroes were human. They had flaws. They had faults. They didn't always do things wrong, right. Whether it's having messy families or or all the stuff that's going to happen. Thank you, God, that you can use flawed people. And we're grateful, Lord, because we know that we too are flawed. But we want to be used by you. And so, Lord, just like we see David do, we want to offer ourselves to you. Would you use us? Would you work in us? Help us to do things your way. In Jesus' name.